Good afternoon, and welcome to the workshop on managing security issues, authentication at the transactional level. Today's workshop will focus on what different stakeholders can do to assure and improve internet security, with a particular focus on authentication in transactions. Our panelists will start out with a discussion of the current state of identity management technology and major issues regarding it that businesses, governments, and consumers face. The panel will then discuss some of the policy issues that arise in connection with identity management and authentication. We'll conclude the panelists' remarks with a discussion of the regulatory and liability issues associated with identity management, including a discussion of the tension that can arise between the benefits to businesses and governments of logging and retaining information, and the concomitant privacy concerns that data retention can raise. I'll look forward periodically during the presentation to bringing in audience questions, so we'll try and stop on occasion to solicit questions from you. So please, as you're going along, think of what you might want to ask our panelists, and I will try and recognize you as we go along. Let me now introduce our distinguished group of organizers and panelists, and it's truly a wonderful panel that's been assembled for you here today. First, Guy Sabin, the Secretary General of the International Chamber of Commerce. Guy has held the position of Secretary General since 2005, and as Chief Executive of the World Business Organization, he oversees a wide array of activities designed to help companies deal with the challenges of global business. Guy has held a number of leadership positions in his distinguished career, most recently a senior advisor to the CEO of Vivendi Universal. Next, let me introduce Marcelo Thompson on the end. Marcelo is a former Attorney General of the Brazilian Information Technology Institute under the office of the President of Brazil. He's held a number of important positions within the Brazilian government and is an accomplished scholar in technology law. Marcelo is currently reading for his doctorate of philosophy in information communication and the social sciences at Kellogg College and Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University. Our panelists today are an exceptional group of experts in the field of digital identity management and privacy. First, to my left and to Guy's left, we have Casper Bowden, who is the Chief Privacy Advisor for Microsoft's Technology Office in the UK. Casper leads the privacy pillar of the Trustworthy Computer Initiative across Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. He brings a balanced perspective not only as a member of industry, but also as a keen advocate of privacy and consumer interests. Next is Dr. Gulshan Rai. Dr. Rai is currently handling multiple responsibilities as Director, Indian Computer Emergency Response Team, Head of E-Security and Cyber Laws Formulation and the Enforcement Division of the Ministry of Communication and Information Technology. He's also Head of the Education and Research Network. He therefore brings the practical experience of policymaker and implementer to today's discussion. And finally, we have Simon Davies, immediately to my right. Simon is widely acknowledged as one of the world's foremost privacy advocates. His work in the areas of civil rights, consumer protection, and technology policy spans nearly 20 years. Simon is perhaps most well known as the founder and director of the watchdog group Privacy International, but he is also an accomplished academic, journalist, broadcaster, and author. Now it is my great pleasure to introduce Guy Sabin, Secretary of the ICC, for his opening remarks.
Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am very pleased to welcome all of you here for participating in the debate organized by the Oxford Internet Institute and ICC. ICC has always been engaged in dealing with these issues related to information technology and especially with internet. All this information are creating now a lot of value, and very often it is said that companies have in their so-called information assets as much value as they have in their classical financial and physical assets. So that explains why it is important to protect this value and then to have all this debate about security and authentication. Obviously, there is an interest for the business community, but it's also important for governments, which are represented here, and also certainly for the consumers. So I will not go longer than that. I am not at all an expert for that. I just wanted to thank you for your participation. And now, Marcello, you have the floor.
Does it work?
Yeah. I'd just like to also welcome you all on behalf of the Oxford Internet Institute. It's an amazing group of panelists, and I think the discussions will be really great. And we had earlier this morning a session on not on authentication technologies, but on fundamental freedoms, and we tackled the issue of privacy. Now it will be also interesting not to see the issue only from a human rights perspective, but also from a business perspective and in a multi-stakeholder setting. So I would also invite you to visit the website of the Oxford Internet Institute to learn about the ongoing projects that we have on authentication technologies, on identity management, and really just now pass the words to Tom, and thank you.
Thank you, Marcello. Thank you, Marcello, and thank you, Guy. So let's get into it. We're going to try and follow a Q&A pattern here. I'm going to ask questions of each of the panelists, and they will comment and have free rein to take the answers where they think most appropriate. But we're going to follow a basic structure, outline some of the issues, get to the policy, and then ultimately to some regulatory and liability issues. So, Casper, let me start off with you. From an industry perspective, and this is a three-part question, what are the major authentication and ID management systems that are in use today? What is the next level of authentication and ID management that you foresee coming down the road? And what are the key issues generally in ID management that you see at this point?
Well, first of all, it's an enormous pleasure to be invited to speak to with this distinguished panel at the IGF. And I've found already that the sort of stimulation from participating with such a diverse group of stakeholders is contributing to my thinking, and I'll be taking back the perspectives to Microsoft. The reality and the starting point for this discussion, I think, from my perspective, is that the internet as we have it today was designed without an identity layer. There is not a universal way of finding out who you're transacting with, and indeed who you're talking with, on the internet. The current state of authentication in e-commerce is probably built as a basic level on simply enrolling at a website with a username and a password, which has to be managed and thought up by the user themselves. There is now plenty of evidence to suggest that people are not really capable of managing a large number of strong passwords, which are used and selected different passwords for different sites, which is clearly a prerequisite for this. Away from the internet and into electronic transaction systems generally, we have around the world quite wide take-up of smart cards, embodying a crypto processor, embodying asymmetric cryptography, and designed around concepts which are generally referred to as public key infrastructure. And when one uses that term, public key infrastructure, I think one should bear in mind that often it is implicitly assumed that that refers to the technical model known as X509. And X509 is now probably sort of 10, 15 years long in the tooth. It has particular technical characteristics. It's extremely hierarchical in conception. And it also is based on a fairly static model of how identity attributes, are encoded into cryptographic certificates. What has happened, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years is we're seeing new standards and protocols emerging, which are generally known as web services. And we can't, in this short session, get into the full architectural implications of web services. But I think what I'd say at this stage is that web services enable a much more flexible and dynamic design of a public key infrastructure or public key infrastructures than that we've assumed previously with what I would call the canonical X509 model. In Microsoft, we've been really, I wonder if revolutionizing is too strong a word, but we've been doing some fundamental rethinking of our attitude and our architectural assumptions about identity systems on the internet. Now, some of you may have come across these ideas, but they generally go by the tag of an identity metasystem. And what we mean by an identity metasystem is a system of systems. Very much as the internet is a network of networks, the realization I think we've come to is that, in some sense, a quest for some kind of universal identity system with particular technical characteristics that can suffice for all contexts and all applications, that quest, if there ever was such a quest, is perhaps misguided. And what we have in reality is a number of different sector-specific identity systems which are tailored and designed and have risk parameters and liability regimes which are designed for particular contexts. And the overarching concept, I think, in the identity metasystem is that we need to find ways to make these sector-specific identity systems interoperate with each other, and to allow an appropriate exchange of identity claims to be made between systems. The other strand that has come through computer science architecture very strongly in the past few years is putting the user in control, or user-centric identity systems. And from the perspective of somebody who's worked now in privacy for about 10 years, I see this as a wholly good thing. If one can, in fact, it is really necessary for control of both security risks and privacy risks, for the user to be in effective control over the authentication interface, and for the user to be able to select from a range of different authentication credentials appropriate to the context in which they're working, but perhaps within the paradigm of a single interface. And that interface is enormously challenging to design, because you have to cope with an enormously wide range of demographics and cultural expectations in how that interface is going to work. However, that is a prize worth pursuing. If one can genuinely put the individual in control of the authentication interface and achieve a truly user-centric architecture, I think this is the way forward for actually guaranteeing good respect for privacy rights, as well as good security properties in the system as a whole.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Caspar. Dr. Rai, let's shift over to the government perspective for a moment. A two-part question for you. First is, what are the macro-level initiatives that the government in India is taking to check systemic risks for online transactions? And then secondly, what are the main identity management issues facing governments today in general, in your view?
Thank you very much. I must take this opportunity to thank IGF for giving opportunity to come and interact with you all. The subject of the systematic risk for online transactions by the government is really a very important issue as far as the India is concerned. For the last 5 years, we have seen the tremendous growth in the online transactions. The last year, the transactions were about $1 billion, the transactions which we committed on the online. Talk about eBay, talk about any other service provider or the online service provider is available and is in the country. The country is also focusing heavily and intensively on the creating the e-governance applications. We are setting up the online networks all across the states, all across the country, as part of our federal structure. And then depending upon and the computerization in the financial sector, insurance sector, and other issue sector is also being encouraged. We have a target that we should achieve the complete online in the next 5 years. Now, looking to the expansion or the activities which are being created there, our country has also put a five-part strategy over there. The primeremost part of the strategy is that we must implement the industry or the service provider must implement the best security practices, and the country has mandated ISO 27001 as the standard which every service provider has to implement. Now, when we had mandated the ISO 27001, the government also created a policy structure where they have empaneled the auditors all over the world who goes and audit the infrastructure from the various components of the ISO 27001. Many of the industry, if you look at it, the India, as far as India is concerned, on the BS7799, the standards, our country has maximum number of certificates in that direction. This panel of the auditors, they help the infrastructure provider or the service provider to audit their systems for first to check the online transactions. We have been also been working out with the industry, particularly the software industry, for the issues in the data protection as well as to the security management practices. We have been working with the Carnegie Mellon University to create a software best practices on the line of CMM, SCI 5, or level 1, 2, 3, 5, where there is a self-certification scheme operates there, and very soon we are going to be back on that security assurance framework which the industry will have to implement. But largely, the industry is focusing on the bilateral kind of security standards to from the security point of view. The second component of the strategy which our government has done to implement the cyber laws, and we have introduced the cyber laws as early as in 2000, and now we are in the process of amending the laws and include few more the issues pertaining to data protection or the offenses part of it to as in line with the technology trend, and it has to move on. It's a technology law and it has to move on from time to time. Our parliament has already group of the parliament has already been gone through the amendments which we have proposed, and I hope very soon we'll have those amendments converted to law. The third part of the strategy which the government is working out is in the area of capacity building. We have arrangements we have done in line with the many of the universities worldwide to train a manpower in implementing security, both at the perimeter level or the device level. That's what the capacity building arrangements are going on. And in our country also, we have set up some centers where the people from different disciplines, different organizations comes and undergo the practical implementation part of the security. The fourth component of the strategy is to do the research and development, and the focus is on the online security or the identity management system which we have to evolve. Ultimately, these are the technology which is difficult to get from elsewhere, and we have to evolve ourselves. That's a focus area for us. And lastly, like many other countries, we have also set up an Indian computer emergency response team which issues the alerts, advisories, and advises of the organizations in the country in the area of information security or the breaches or the vulnerabilities. These are the five-component strategy which the government of India is looking at it, and we are going ahead with that. We found a lot of progress has been made, and I think time to come we learn from the worldwide practices and implement it. The main identity management issue, the second questions which we face today, is largely the phishing issues, because our financial sector or the insurance sector is in the process of computerizing. We have somewhere around 30 financial banks there, 50% of which have already computerized the online banking operations and the internet banking operations. Till a year ago, we didn't have the cases, maybe sporadic cases, one or two cases pertaining to phishing there. But now the cases or the phishing it started increasing. Almost we are looking at 2 or 3 cases per day in our country. That's the major issues which we are facing in our country there. But as compared to the fishing cases worldwide, our numbers are very, very limited there. What we are trying to work out with the banks here is that every bank, while opening the internet banking account, they would give a software for the filtering of the sites to the subscriber or the bank account holder, and those need to be implemented and need to be audited by the bank from time to time. Apart from that, we have also gone through in the PKI, of course the number is less, but slowly and slowly the PKI users are increasing it. As of now, we don't face much issues there, but we are quite vigilant, and we are trying to learn from the world's experience and trying to implement both in terms of technology practices as well as the legal framework. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rai. Simon, let me turn to you. From the consumer protection and privacy perspective, what are the major consumer and privacy issues affecting authentication and ID management that you see today, both from the public side and the private side, if you care to comment on both?
Yes, definitely. And can I also offer my thanks to our hosts for the opportunity to speak here. The big problem, as I see it, is that identity has worldwide become politicized. And what's happened as a result is that authentication is becoming politicized. And this is because governments such as that of the United Kingdom have seen that identity is an opportunity to create a sort of one-stop solution to a whole range of apparent social dysfunctions. You could say illegal working, you could say unlawful immigration, you could say criminality. Social dysfunction at whatever level you want can be sorted with an identity policy. Now, the problem there is that governments then attempt to grab hold of, they want to be the gatekeepers of authentication, which is what's been happening in the United Kingdom. Fortunately, other countries are not so readily pursuing that route, but we have to be very careful. The issue as I see it is that authentication should very much be a competitive environment. And an organization, because authentication is going to become a big industry over the next 2 or 3 decades, a big industry. It should be a competitive industry, and one of the points of competition, we hope, will be consumer rights and consumer privacy. The problem is when government wades in with its size 12 boots, demanding that authentication services comply with government mandate, that, for example, authentication services must use a government root identity, then we start to run into problems for reasons which will be apparent to all of you who have dealt with large IT systems within government. I've been looking at some authentication services in detail, both in the United States and Europe, and there are some signs that there is hope that privacy can be maintained. For example, sites that make sure that no centralized data reserve is kept. There is password verification, for example, but only a hash of the password is kept by the organization. Profiling is maintained, but the profiling is real-time and is not kept. There is no reserve, like no sort of profile that is linked to an individual. Where I see the greatest threat is where organizations decide that they're going to actually pursue the worst practice of government by collecting every piece of information they can for some possible potential use in the future. That is where there will be grave problems from a security perspective and from a privacy perspective. We do believe, as privacy advocates, that we don't have to reinvent the wheel. There are principles that exist now and have for 20 years that will allow authentication and authentication industry to move forward in a way that protects people, and that is minimize your data, make it purpose-specific, necessary, don't use it for purposes which it was never intended. If those 4 principles can be maintained, then we'll end up with a slim, efficient, cost-effective, privacy-friendly authentication solution worldwide. Go in any other direction, and I'm afraid we have a situation where not just is privacy endangered, but you won't build trust with your consumers, and you won't build a competitive environment for authentication services.
Thank you very much, Simon. I'd like to stop right there because there's a pretty good amount of information already on the table. Does anyone have any questions for any of the panelists at this point? If you do, just raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. You don't have to restrict it to the comments that they've made so far if you like. A question in the back? No? Just stretching, I guess. No? We haven't said anything controversial enough, I guess. All right, well, let's kick it into another gear. Let's see what else we can come up with. Casper, let me ask you to comment on something, and this is coming from more of a populist view, I guess. Even today, there are certain ID management things that we go through. Probably all of us in this room have a number of different ID management tools in their wallets or their purses. Could you maybe just talk a little bit about some of the common ID management activities that go on in our everyday lives and maybe how that might change a bit?
Well, what I'm trying to bring this into a very concrete realm of examples. But we might think today how it is that we use identity tokens in everyday life. So, for example, when I check into my hotel, they want to see generally two kinds of identity tokens from me. They want to see often a passport and, generally speaking, a credit card. And in return for presenting those two identity tokens, I get an authentication token back, which is my room key. And what that sort of paradigmatic example shows us is that the tokens that we have, and you know, in my wallet at least, you know, we have a bunch of different representations of an identity relationship, a piece of plastic. And each of these representations of an identity relationship has an appropriate context. So, for example, you know, we wouldn't have the expectation that we would be able to cross a border of a country by using a loyalty card. We wouldn't have the expectation that we can go to our bank and draw money out with a passport as a token by itself. So, in some sense, informally, I think we're all quite used to managing a plurality of different tokens representing different identity relationships. But what we do all the time is token exchange. We offer one or two tokens to a particular offerer of services, a service provider, and in return, we get back a different token of authentication, which lets us do something else. In the case I just offered, it lets us into our hotel room. So we can think about maybe abstracting and generalizing that model into a very general model where you have an entity that we would call an identity provider that is an entity that we have a relationship with already that knows us or some aspect of us, and a relying party. And a relying party is where we want to make some transaction. It could be, for example, to buy a book from an online bookstore. It could be a financial services organization online. And the general abstraction that we have sort of come to think about this in Microsoft is you want to do business with some relying party. You, the individual, or the data subject, have then get presented with some policy requirements by that relying party. The relying party specifies the kinds of identity information that they want from you in order to do that transaction. And then you have to think, what identity relationships do I have with certain organizations? They could be government organizations, they could be private sector organizations. What identity relationships do I have that enable me to satisfy those policy requirements of the relying party? And if I have some of those identity relationships, I can get some identity claims, which in the realm of the internet would be digitally signed cryptographic security tokens, actually encapsulating this identity information. And we basically take this information from the identity provider that we have relationships with. We have a good look at them and actually see that they contain the information they're supposed to contain, you know, no more and no less. And then we pass on that information to the relying party. The relying party then satisfies themselves that these identity claims are reliable according to the judgment of the relying party. and then we can transact. So that was rather a long-winded explanation of something that, you know, is in some sense terribly obvious, but that abstraction I think is helpful because it allows us to see that everyday transactions in real life or indeed on the internet all can be sort of subsumed into this abstraction of a relationship with an identity provider and then the relying party needing fulfillment of some identity claims. I can see Ralph is bursting to get in, so maybe we should give him a chance.
Let's turn it over to Ralph. I see you and Casper know each other, so please.
Yeah, maybe I can start with a short commercial break because we have a very similar workshop on especially the privacy aspect of identity management tomorrow in this room at the same time, and Casper is also on that. My name is Ralf Bendrath. I'm at the University of Bremen in Germany. Casper, I really like this starting point to start with examples everybody knows, like stuff you have in your wallet, credit cards, ID cards, membership cards, and so on. But that also shows that with a lot of identity tokens, it's absolutely not necessary that the identity provider knows about my transactions. When I show my ID card or my passport, when I cross a border or something, my issuing authority back in Germany, where I got the passport from, does not need to know that I'm crossing this or that border at any given point. Similar with my hotel room key. Some hotels still do this. If you have electronic room keys, they still lock when you enter your room, but in Germany they just got a Big Brother award for that. That's not really what we want. So I think that's important to think about how we can ensure this also in internet identity management. That's one point. And the other point is, in the beginning you said, if I quote you correctly, we need the sector-specific ID systems to interoperate with each other. Could you explain to me why my sports club membership card and my passport and my credit card and my hotel room key have to interoperate with each other?
So to take those points in order, so one of the biggest privacy dilemmas, I think, in moving to this era of electronic credentials is when we have been used to using paper credentials, the way in which you show a paper credential is the paper credential will normally have some serial number or some identity number on it, but you show it, and this is the way things used to work, you know, 10, 20 years ago, you show it, and the person inspecting that satisfies themselves that it's valid through a visual inspection, and then you pass through whatever authentication barrier it is. But it would not be normal, it has not been historically normal, every time you use every credential for a record to be kept and the person at the gateway, as it were, to write down the serial number every time. Sometimes there were instances when that might happen, but generally only for the highest kind of security. However, in the world of electronic credentials, it is kind of technically trivial to make a record of that flow of transactions and to keep that record, you know, arbitrarily long according to the policy of the person keeping that record. So there is this perhaps sort of seduction that in moving to electronic credentials, on the one hand, we want to keep models of identity management which are familiar and intuitive, but on the other hand, there is this risk that privacy can become undermined if one accepts unthinkingly that simply the technical ability to keep a record of all these transactions, just because it can be done, that it ought to be done. To take the second part of your question, can you just remind me what the second part of your question was? Sorry, my mind's going. So I think the simple answer to that is it's one thing to say that technical identity systems, for reasons of convenience and scale and procurement, that most of the systems that will be procured will be standards-based. And there will be circumstances when different contextual identity systems will be need to interoperate and share identity claims. But it's an entirely different question to say that a system may have the technical capacity to interoperate. It's an entirely different question to say whether or not in the actual operation in society they should exchange information. And I want to be perfectly clear about that. I mean, one is a level of technical engineering, and the other is a level of policy decision. And that is going to involve both market actors and the consumer actors and government actors. So What I want to be quite clear about is I think that the standards-based identity systems which web services enable, they do have, if they're designed well, the ability and the capacity to exchange information. Whether they should do is an entirely different matter in a particular circumstance. Now, I mean, let's take a particular example of that. If you have a government identity provider, for example, that has a record of, say, driving licenses in a particular country and actually shows how many kind of points you are away from disqualification if you've been speeding too much, or, for example, may have address information because in order to actually perform law enforcement functions in connection with driving licenses, that might be a necessary piece of information. Now, as a technical matter, it would be possible for that driving license agency to actually issue digital identity claims to another agency. And in some sense, you have a particular relationship with a driving license agency where, for example, to obtain, say, qualification to, maybe if you have some incapacity which enables you to some subsidy for helping you with your driving if you're disabled, you might need to have a registration of that with the driver's license agency, and you might need to make a proof of that to another government agency, or maybe some private sector body to claim a subsidy. But whether or not, and the extent to which that information should be shared, is a policy decision, and the privacy implications of that policy decision need to be very carefully considered. So the architecture is entirely flexible. The architecture of this interoperability between different spheres of identity systems, I think, is very flexible. But the extent to which the pluralism between identity providers, the actual granularity of that, how that should actually be shaped, that is a decision to be worked out by multiple stakeholders.
Dr. Rai, perhaps the second part of the question from Rolf about the interaction between different types of authentication cards and so forth from the government perspective, passports, driver's license, and other forms of government authentication. Could you comment on that from your perspective as well? And then I think Simon had had a few thoughts as in addition.
The main factor which we find is the technology, the process, and the how the dispute resolution takes place. And the process, the setting up the process in these three areas, in the particular two areas of process and the legal framework, are far lagging behind when we talk about the technology implementation over there. The cost of the identity management solution, demonstration of the technological solution, availability of the technology are the primary issues which goes into the mind of the consumer. And those are difficult to do that, and it has to come over a period of time. Today, if you find, I mean, I went through a study about a couple of months ago where they find that in a state like Australia, the overall online users, the percentage of the people has come down. And the study also reflected that the factor largely was these factors, technology factor and the process, these are the factors which were responsible for bringing down the usage by almost 0.5% things over there. We need to make available the technology. We need to make the process. We need to put the process in picture, and the dispute resolution. These three factors, and the government has to put it. Largely, we have to bring the industry and the consumer together and resolve the problems over there. If we have to increase the online usage or the identity management issues over there.
Just a couple of thoughts tangential to this discussion. I think when we talk about authentication, we often do think of tokens, of physical things. Where I believe that there's going to be a change for the good, where we don't have to link things and databases together, is where we start giving some latitude to consumers to choose different ways that they can verify or authenticate themselves. I think of challenge and response questions, for example. I think of biometrics. I don't have a problem inherently with biometrics so long as we as citizens are in control of it. And if an organization says, look, you know, you're comfortable using your eyes, we have an iris recognition system here, you feel comfortable using it, we will not keep the data, or at least we will in some way secure the data. I don't necessarily have a problem with that. It gives us one more way that we can ensure that we are known to a system for a particular purpose. It's where, of course, organizations or governments say we're going to mass biometrically print the entire population. That's where civil libertarians like myself have a problem. But the second issue is, I'm going to say that the awful truth, of course, is that no matter how we talk about minimizing data, minimizing connection between identity systems and tokens, the reality is that there is this constant shift to remove liability. You see it in banks, for example. You know, when we used cash, then the central bank took all liability. Then we started moving to credit cards and the banks took the liability. Now we're moving to chip and PIN so that the consumer takes the liability. And you see this with identity too, that there's more of a push, a liability push onto the individual and onto small organizations. You see that there are requirements. I look at communications data retention, for example, where organizations don't want to keep information for 12 months. They have to by law. And as you'll start to see in the next 24 months, laws that will be placed, liability laws and requirements on authentication providers, it will require them to capture a greater amount of information so the state can use it in the future. That's this, I think, is the sleeping giant that waits for us in these discussions.
Thank you very much, Simon. We have a question in the front.
My question is very different from... I only wanted to know that as a user, would any of you, or especially Casper, be able to tell the difference between authentication and identification? My face in itself is an identification. And when we start talking about authentication, we are trying to go to a range of technologies for trying to authenticate my own self. So as a user, if I'm suddenly being overloaded by different tools and different technologies and different ways of authenticating myself for making simple purchases at different... So I think it's an overload on a user. So therefore, if there is a research or if the industry is looking at authentication, which is, you know, you look at my face and I'm authenticated for making use of my own, financial package to make use of certain services. So is there something wherein you can actually differentiate between authentication and identification? That would be useful.
So I'm very glad somebody asked that question. And I would say there are two distinct aspects to that question. The first aspect, I think, is the question of how much the individual user of the system understands what is going on. Because unless the mental model that the user has in their head about what the process is, unless that is a fairly faithful mental model about what the underlying security and privacy risks to that individual is, I would say that any privacy or security protection that system is designed to give is illusory. The individual must be aware and in control. Well, they must be aware to be in control. So when we talk about user-centric identity management system, it is a precondition of the design of such systems that we crack the extremely difficult problem of finding an interface design which is intuitively accessible, which has a good match to people's mental model of how that system is going to work as far as it affects their security and privacy. But the other reason I'm glad you raised that question is I lost the thread halfway through my first answer to the first part of Ralph's question when we were talking about the difference between paper documents and electronic documents and how it is sort of technically trivial with electronic tokens to make a log record where essentially you note down the serial number or the identity number associated with that token or document. And that clearly has very serious privacy consequences. And roughly speaking, there's two levels of mitigation that one can apply to the privacy issues. One is to ensure that if we get this user interface design right, and we actually allow the user to manage a number of different credentials, which their mental model and the interface design is a good match, and so people are comfortable using a different token for a different context in an identity system. Well, the first thing you can then do is ensure that you don't have some sort of universal serial number, where by design you actually ensure that the usage of one particular token in one context cannot be instantly and trivially correlated through some common universal identifier with the usage of a different token in a different context. So it is possible to have an interface where the user does have effective control over different tokens and use them in different contexts, but where, if you like, the electronic traces are not going to be just trivially able to be correlated. However, there has been an enormous amount of computer science research and cryptography research over the past 15, 20 years aimed at solving that problem in a rather deeper way. And essentially, the problem they've been trying to solve is this problem of the difference between paper documents and electronic documents, where if you show somebody a paper document, they may or may not write down the serial number on that document. And similarly, as I said, if you show somebody an electronic document, it seems inevitable that somebody could make a record of, if you like, the serial number associated with that electronic document. However, now there has been breakthroughs in cryptographic research over the past 10 or 15 years where essentially cryptographic protocols have been designed which can achieve something which is very counterintuitive, which particularly I think for policymakers and administrators is almost so counterintuitive it may actually be very hard to assimilate as a technical policy option. And that is a kind of credential where it is possible to perform authentication that the token is a valid credential, but the cryptography is so designed that you do not leave actually a persistent identifier behind when you use that credential. So in some sense, you're getting the best of both worlds from the privacy and security point of view. You're getting the security benefits of strong authentication, but you are not, in a technical sense, doing an identifiable transaction. And the cryptography research in this direction has been quite specific at actually performing this bit of magic. But that is a very, very difficult idea to assimilate at the policymaking level, because I think, you know, crudely, one can think of computers and identity systems as being really like filing cabinets with an index number. And people may have one index number or several index numbers, but it seems very counterintuitive to imagine a technology where you can perform the operation of authentication without, in a technical sense, identifying somebody. But yet we do have technical options to do this now. So there is a large question, I think, over the multi-stakeholder debate that should take place about how we can improve awareness of these technical options, because one thing is absolutely certain is that unless there is awareness amongst the business drivers and the people actually procuring and designing their administration systems, whether in the public sector or the private sector, unless they are aware that such technical options exist, they will never actually be deployed and they will never actually fulfill the privacy potential and security potential which they were conceived for in research.
One of the underlying concerns, I think, and we wanted to talk a little bit about, is the notion that as we hear more and more stories about phishing and identity theft, that consumers may lose confidence in their ability to transact over the internet. So maybe we could turn our focus to consumer confidence and consumer protection issues for a moment. Dr. Rai, from your perspective, what factors influence consumer confidence in online transactions in your country?
In our country, the major factor is the technology, the security on the network, security on the transactions. And again, when we talk about the security, it's again the
how do we implement it, the cost to the vendors or cost to the consumer, the fast accessibility, fast redressal of the disputes. These are the factors in our country which are affecting the influencing the consumer confidence online. Of course, we are trying to build up the laws over there. We are trying to build up the consumer protection acts in a strong manner. But again, as I said, that it takes time, and by the time technology changes and you get into the different circle over there. So largely the technological solution we need to demonstrate to the people there. We need to demonstrate the confidence in the sense that their issues, their complaints are readdressed by the courts and there is a proper legal framework over there. And again, and what Tulikal said and Casper said about it, I think the issue of repudiation is far more important when we talk about the strong implementation of the authentication technique. So we need to have address the issues of the legal dispute resolution as well as demonstration of technology so that they bring confidence of the consumers more and more on the net. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Raya. Simon, keeping on the theme of consumer protection, do you believe that today the consumer protection laws are an adequate check on privacy abuses, and if not, why not? And going forward, do you think the consumer laws as they're currently structured are adequate, and if not, how they might change? It's a lot in one question.
A difficult answer to give, in that, of course, with so many jurisdictions across the world, it's hard to know. It's hard to give a pen sketch of what works and doesn't work. I know that in many companies, in many countries, both privacy law and consumer protection law fundamentally fail, partly because regulators responsible for those laws are very often under-resourced or timid, or they're simply little better than civil servants acting out their role on behalf of government. So it's sometimes what you have to do is differentiate. I think that there's a big problem worldwide in terms of empowering customers. I think sometimes that the law, it's okay, I think it depends on the model you approach. I mean, if you take this from a punitive perspective, that there is going to be a huge crackdown, let's say, on phishing, or that there is going to be a massive consumer education exercise, well, that solves part of the problem. I suspect that what we're looking at now goes beyond law in terms of a solution, and that is market-based solutions where customers can achieve some sort of level of confidence and trust through innovative solutions. And I've spoken to a few companies that are, for example, looking at ways that customers themselves can tailor-make the appearance of a site. And very often it's difficult to sort of say to customers, well, here are the signs you've got to look for to find out whether you've got a spoof site, internet site. But if you actually get them engaged, you can build their confidence. And the more levels of engagement you have with the customer, the more difficult it is to create a generic phishing expedition. So there is the possibility that what we're looking at here is law that is fundamentally obsolete when it comes to fast-moving technological developments. I also have very, very little faith, frankly, in regulators generally who are responsible for consumer protection. Sometimes it works, normally not. I would prefer, rather than us looking at legal-based solutions, I would prefer that what we saw was government investing its money in helping companies develop technological solutions to engage the customer. Innovative, powerful, personalized, that are also educational. Now, I'm sure that there are ways government could do that, but at the moment, the message is counterproductive. You see, for example, I'll give you one thunderingly terrible example. There are multiple governments around the world scaring consumers witless about identity theft. So on the one hand, they're saying, well, you know, we have this big problem with the internet and all the phishing and farming and spoofing and whatever else, which is all being, you know, propelled through the junk mail enterprises. But you've got government also falsely, I think, often alarming people over identity theft. So saying that the consequences are far greater than they really are. We know identity theft is a big problem, yes. But honestly, there's a bit of a conspiracy alive and well between police forces who are desperate for new budgets, government that's desperate to show that it's on the cutting edge, being alert about crime, working together really to create a wave of paranoia about many levels of identity theft. So a lot of people aren't going near e-commerce services because they're too terrified that, you know, their lives will be destroyed from there on in if they dare enter into a site they don't understand. So what I'm saying is there has to be a level of responsibility by governments and by police to tell the truth, to give a clear, honest interpretation of these threats. And I would extend that to the finance industry too, who, by the way, does have a liability to protect their customers. Credit reporting agencies that should make it easier for customers to deal with an identity theft problem. But instead, there's this just sort of amorphous threat that's being put out there. And that, I think, is putting people off. So I think sort of responsible leadership in this area, responsible education, and responsible use of media, coupled with innovative solutions. That's where I see the future.
Do we have any questions in the audience? Any responses, any reactions to fear-mongering by governments? Governments could possibly do such a thing. Who can imagine? No. All right. Well, let me ask Casper. Phishing is obviously a huge problem, identity theft, fraud, and so forth. If we were to follow the model that you were describing in your opening remarks, does all of that go away, or how much of it?
Well, I don't know how many people here have had the experience of getting a phone call, maybe a phone call at home, and the phone call says something like, "Hello, it's your bank here, and we have possibly some fraud incidents that you should concern yourself with, and we need to sort of check some information from you. So first of all, we'd like to take you through the authentication process." So has it ever occurred to you how you know who's telephoning you? I mean, if we, obviously I'm using this as an analogy to a phishing attack, but we're very used to being asked as individuals to authenticate ourselves to some organization. But it's not always designed into the process that we have a good way that an organization can authenticate itself to us. And this cuts both ways in different scenarios, in different circumstances. And on the internet, what I think has emerged is that it's absolutely vital to build into the security design of an identity system that the authentication is two-way, that both you can have a means, which again has to be intuitively robust, of authenticating that you are visiting the correct website, but also the website is going to need to know that, for in the interest of your own privacy, the website is going to need to know that you are the same person who originally enrolled with that website. And that's precisely what we're attempting to do with the mechanism that I described. And I should say at the outset that we've been working on these concepts of the identity system, identity metasystem, with many other partners in the technology industries. And I'm very pleased to say that this has become, you know, it was never conceived that it should be a Microsoft-only initiative, but there's now absolutely no danger of that. We have, I think, very, very many technology companies who are normally very strong competitors and rivals with Microsoft, I think really endorsing a very similar set of principles. In Microsoft, we have started this dialogue with the rest of the industry by through the initiative of Microsoft's Architect of Identity, a colleague of mine who I've worked with very closely now called Kim Cameron. And Kim came up with a set of what I would call empirical engineering principles, which we've called rather cheekily the laws of identity. So we have defined seven engineering principles about how we believe any particular identity system for a specific purpose, but a common set of principles that they should all really adhere to. Now, if you design your identity system for a particular purpose with particular properties, which follows these laws of identity, then they would be able to have the technical capacity to exchange information with each other in a way that is safe for privacy and safe for security, in principle. There's a lot of detail that has to be worked out. But the concept of this having a cryptographic architecture which is flexible enough to guarantee some basic security and privacy properties, but actually also work with particular identity systems designed architecturally with more particular characteristics, that's actually quite a, that's been quite a tough nut to crack. But we believe that the fundamental architecture that, that we have arrived at is suitable for that. So, for example, the fundamental architecture would be capable of interoperating with some of these cryptographic systems I mentioned earlier, which have very, very strong privacy properties indeed, and actually can perform authentication operations without doing any identification whatsoever. Now, why might you want to use that? That sounds like maybe a little bit too extreme on the privacy side. Well, let me give you an example. There are many transactions on the internet where some kind of proof of age is going to be necessary. It could be young people, where you want to create some kind of walled garden, where you know that only people under a certain age are participating in that community. It could equally be that somebody wants to buy adult goods or services, and therefore they have to show that they are over a certain age. So what you really want, given that date of birth is incredibly sensitive identifying information, you can really identify about 70% of people in a given population, you know, really just knowing kind of last name and date of birth. You don't really want to go splattering your date of birth around too many places. Instead, what you want is some kind of assertion that says you are over a certain age or under a certain age, backed by a digital signature from some identity provider that the relying party will have justifiable reason to trust. And there are many different identity providers that would have to be in that position for different relying parties and different kinds of transactions. But for privacy reasons, what you don't want necessarily is for the identity provider to track every place you've used that proof of age. If the identity provider was in that kind of panoptic point of view, that would be extremely privacy invasive. So again, we have taken care in the design of our architecture that it is possible to do both. It is both possible to have transactions where the identity provider does know where the relying party or who the relying party is for these transactions, and also where the identity provider does not know where you use these identity claims. And an example of where you probably would want the identity provider to know where you have transacted is some kind of financial payment transaction. And if I use a credit card in, you know, the conventional financial model, and I transact with somebody to buy something, well, something could go wrong. I mean, I might find a spurious charge on my credit card bill. Now, in order to be able to do dispute resolution on that, it's going to be necessary for the identity provider to be able to say, well, our records show that this transaction happened with this relying party. Because if you don't have that information, then there's simply no trail on which you can begin a dispute resolution process. On the other hand, in the scenario of this proof of age, that there will be many circumstances there where it is neither necessary nor, frankly, at all desirable for privacy reasons for the identity provider to have that visibility into where these transactions occur. So that's what we've been very careful to achieve in this architecture, is you can do both. But that just means we have the technical capacity to do both. The policy decision of when it's appropriate to do one or the other, that is going to be, in some cases, a contested decision. And that, again, I think should be a multi-stakeholder decision that where privacy regulators exist should involve those privacy regulators.
One last question before we move over to some regulatory and liability questions. Dr. Rai, what do you perceive as the most significant barriers to improving authentication in online transactions and communications?
I perceive the number of barriers over there. The first most thing my experience shows that the exposure and the awareness
of the different technology available in the market and the availability of that technology to the organization for the implementation, that itself is a barrier there, and a lot more need to be done to expose the consumer in this regard. Whatever technology is available there is limited, it is from limited sources there. There is issues of technology transfer. And the four more important thing, there the issues of standards and the interoperability issues are very strong there. And I think the cost is another factor which the consumer or the face, and we need to for the improving the authentication over there. The issue of standard definitely need to be addressed, particularly in this sector, which is a strong input of technologies there when you talk about the authentication there. So far, we have, we look at the PKI, there is nothing more available other than PKI, where the legal frame, when we talk about legal framework, we have gone on electronic signature, and largely, but we are using the PKI forum over there. So I think with these factors are important and need to be handled in a very coordinated manner, and there needs to be more work needs to be done in all these three areas.
Thank you, Dr. Rai. Simon, let me turn over to you as we kind of shift gears into the area of regulation and liability. Understanding that governments may have some odd incentives or maybe promoting more concern than they should be amongst consumers. Let's talk about a government or a program, I should say, that might work. So the question is basically this. Are government-imposed approval and accreditation schemes necessary to instill trust in ID management and authentication? Or, in your view, are voluntary programs sufficient to encourage consumer confidence?
Casper and I might have a interesting dispute over this one. I'm not sure. I think there is a theoretical argument, an argument in principle, that government should be or could be the repository for the root identity data on a person. Now, that doesn't mean that basically the rest of your life is determined by access to what the government has created. But it might mean that, for example, it could be the government system could be a point of reference if you're going to triangulate for a person's, to authenticate a person at certain points of their lives. I strongly disagree with the idea that a totally voluntary regime would work. I think part of the problem there is the, again, it's difficult for the consumer to know what works and what doesn't work. Then on the other hand, it's difficult to know which governments are going to actually suggest what works and what doesn't work. So, you know, it's a bit of a, because this is an emerging area. I suspect that perhaps the answer lies in some more collaborative approach between industry and government. I think, yeah, government, I think, does have a role to play. I mean, government is also required to identify and authenticate an individual. It has a right to and it has a legal obligation to. We have this natural assumption that government does it better than anybody else because it has the power of legal compulsion. I don't entirely think that works. I've not seen any evidence, I've not seen any analysis that shows that government could embark on a voluntary scheme with any greater success than a private sector organization. But when it comes to the issuing of passports, for example, I can see the government does have a role. But yes, I think we got a huge issue here, and that is to what extent can you have a root identity system with a number of satellite voluntary systems that make occasional reference to it? I would say that if we're to look at two systems, one where the government was the gatekeeper of all authentication and all identification, and the second one where it was a free-for-all amongst voluntary systems, I don't think either is going to work. I think somewhere there is that horrible word balance through negotiation that needs to be struck.
Dr. Rai, if I could ask you to comment on the same question. Is a government mandate better? Is a voluntary system better? Or is there something in between?
We feel that the role of the government should be facilitator and enabler. It should not get into the regulation unnecessarily where it is not required. The first approach should be to evolve a consensus among the industry and the users. And the consensus should be mandated, and that's the best way to work with, because the implementation as well as the enforcement is much easier and is followed by everybody. Of course, the mandation is necessary, but the voluntary program over a period of time, we have not seen functioning very well when you talk about the self-regulation. In India, we have a couple of self-regulatory organizations. And over a period of time, the self-interest develops and the whole system cracks slowly and slowly there. So while it should be the voluntary involvement, but the government should mandate it, because that gives a lot of confidence to the users as well as the other agencies who are involved over there.
Casper, do you want to respond to Simon here?
Well, I was listening very closely to what Simon said, because we don't normally disagree about much, and I'm not sure what I was supposed to disagree with there. I don't think there was much there. A few comments that I would add. One is that I think that in the area of privacy, we should not be too starry-eyed about what is achievable in terms of market forces for guaranteeing privacy. There may be very vigorous economic competition between alternate providers for services in terms of actually competing for the custom of the user. But that doesn't necessarily equate to there being good, effective privacy choices for the user. You can actually have a range of vigorously competing services in terms of economic competition, but actually underneath the surface, the privacy practices and the privacy policies will be very similar and not actually offer much effective choice. And I think that does raise the question about the role of privacy regulators in this question of identity architecture. And I think what is becoming clear from research into this over now, you know, what is 10 or 15 years of very concerted research, is that all identity architectures are not equal for privacy. Any idea that there is some kind of automatic technological neutrality in terms of the impact on privacy between different identity architectures is simply not true. Some architectures are better for privacy than others. And that is why, you know, we've been making a particular effort to reach out to privacy regulators and to try and, you know, get them really more interested in these questions of identity architecture at a technical level, and to try and work through some of the ramifications that are foreseeable in terms of the consequences for privacy protection. And I think that process is a long way to go. I think that we've seen, you know, in parts of the world and with particular regulators, in really significant degrees of technical literacy and real commitment to trying to get ahead of some of these privacy implications of identity architecture. Other areas, the penny doesn't seem to have dropped yet. And I think there's more work to do. That's all I'll say on those.
So we talked earlier about liability that came up in one of the previous responses. So let me put the question more directly to each of the panelists. Who should be liable when the safeguards and the processes break down and there is a loss, a financial loss or other harm in resulting from a breakdown of the system? Dr. Rai, would you like to start?
I feel there is a clear role the government has to play here. Once you set the process and the principles in consensus approach, and the liability should be with the government to enforce those principles and make the safeguards implementable, as well as they be responsible for the process back breakdown. It's a government, clear-cut government responsibility to
handle that and to see that things goes through properly with.
Why don't we just go right down the line, Casper?
Liability.
Who should be liable?
So I think there's going to be no single model that will emerge. I think in the abstract model I've described of an identity provider, a relying party, and the use of this term, an identity claim, a digital identity claim or a claim about some aspect of one's digital identity. It is implicit in the word claim that there is no ultimate standard of truth which can be pre-certified and ought to be accepted without question. I think it is implicit in that model that it is really for the relying party to make an evaluation of the sort of whether the identity claims and the provenance of those identity claims ultimately is satisfactory to the relying party. But this actually interacts with privacy in quite an interesting way. The question of how much identity information the relying party is going to demand in order to transact is an open-ended question. If I go to a bookshop, I don't expect to be asked for my shoe size. If I want to get car insurance, I don't expect to be asked about details of, say, which books I like to read. So, on the other hand, I think in many businesses and in many web-based businesses, there is the assumption that more information about the user is better. So the question arises: is who is going to be the arbiter of actually how much information it is appropriate to ask the individual in order to transact in any particular transaction context? In regimes where you have privacy regulators have a theoretical dispensation to say that, no, that is excessive information, that is too much information for that context. In other traditions, there are essentially, this is an idea of user choice, providing notice is given of how much information is being acquired, and providing there is a choice to transact or not to transact, but that could be in a pretty much all or nothing sense, then that is assumed to produce a satisfactory range of outcomes for the individual. But as we move to online authentication systems and user-centric identity systems, it may be that we will find that there is a tendency under the system left to itself for too much information to be drawn out from the individual without effective choices. And I think we'll have to wait and see if that becomes a problem and how serious a problem that becomes.
Yeah, please.
Just very quickly, I think part of the problem is we often see that liability is a financial issue. Who has liability for failure of systems? I think Casper touched on something, which is the liability that falls upon you at a number of levels to disclose information. And what we're seeing is under this regime of rights and responsibilities, great new Labour theme, that there is an obligation that is imposed, a liability consequent on the disclosure of data. And we've now seen this in a number of European governments, particularly, where disclosure or the forced required disclosure of information is now, it's reached endemic and epidemic proportions. And often it's okay, it can be something very simple like, okay, I go into a pub, I expect, well not me, but any number of people would be expected perhaps to produce proof of age. Fine. Now you're being required to disclose a fingerprint. Why? Because it's a responsibility upon you as a drinker to help the great collective cause of security. This is the big problem. This is where we start running against any number of cultural, personal, neighborhood issues, financial issues that bring a great consequence down upon the individual for not disclosing information in a variety of circumstances. So it goes well beyond an information systems context into the broader societal one.
Thank you, Simon. We had a question up here in the front.
Yes. Thank you. I'm Henning Mortensen from the Confederation of Danish Industries. In Denmark, it has been quite difficult to get the government to be interested in securing the citizens' privacy in general. We have tried to be quite constructive, I think, and write different papers and recommendations, and also telling them about different technologies. However, we were not really heard until we wrote a catalog describing 50 known cases of public privacy breaches. And this catalog made the government change the national digital strategy. I was wondering if you have any experience on how to create awareness on this kind of technologies, that is privacy enhancing technologies, among politicians and public decision makers. Some general points that it could be interesting for all of us who wants to affect them on this.
In Britain, we've done it very simply. We've shifted the liability onto politicians who vote for policies in support of those technologies. So, for example, if there is a privacy-invasive technique or technology, we've now helped adjust the political temperature in the House of Commons to such an extent that there is a real penalty that those politicians have to pay. So now you're starting to see a change in the voting pattern of the Parliament. It took us years. We tried to educate. We tried lots of ways to inform people. It was only, none of it really worked. You know, we've done, I don't know, Privacy International has done about 50,000 media interviews in its time, and it hasn't made one jot of difference, frankly. But go to the politicians, go to the parliament, start playing the party political game, and it's funny how things change. Now encryption, privacy-enhancing technologies, and so on and so on, are actually a discussion point amongst the political parties. So I would urge everybody to do that. It does work.
Anyone else care to respond to that, Dr. Rai or Casper?
Well, being slightly guarded in my answer, I can sort of tell you a little bit about a dialogue that we had with a particular government. I won't say which government and which part of the world, but it was a government that was contemplating introducing an identity card system of a very monolithic character, where essentially a single identifier would be used for many different purposes. And we were explaining sort of some of the ideas that I've set out today about the identity meta system and about how privacy either emerges or can be impaired through architecture and fundamental architectural choices. We found the government minister, we had a dialogue at that level to say, well, this is wonderful. I mean, I like the model that you're offering me, but my advisors have told me that what you're proposing is impossible and that we have to do it this monolithic way. And, we turned around that the thinking of that minister for about 3 weeks. And after that, we found that perhaps he had been got at by his officials, and that the progress that we had made, I think, towards getting acceptance that another architecture was possible, shall we say, appeared to have dissipated. And why this happens is a very deep question that both Simon and I have been, working at for many, many years. And it's a deep question of political science and the culture of administration. But it does appear to be a pretty universal phenomena. It does seem very difficult to, at the level of administration and policymaking, to get privacy considered as a technical matter. It is all too often seen as a legal and regulatory bolt-on. And I think we know enough about the architectural questions now to know that, there does have to be privacy by design in order for these things to have a chance of being adequately considered.
All right, well, I want to thank... Oh, I'm sorry, we have one more question, please.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Hanan Bujami. I'm from Diplo Foundation. I want to clarify something. If you have any idea about some of the authentication methods that are being used by some governments, I'm aware that, for example, in England, they have electoral roll, which is like a government entity containing a database of people who are aged more than 18 years old. And it's been actually used by companies dealing with online transaction as a security measure in order to authenticate the customers that they have. So I was wondering if other countries, you know, are having the same experience or trying, because it's a service which is, I know that it is provided by the UK government, and it's up to the people to register in it, which respects the privacy part of this topic. So actually, people, UK citizens, have the choice to register in the electoral roll, which facilitates, in one way, they're dealing with online transaction companies, meaning that if I'm a credit card holder, it will be easier for me to be registered in the electoral roll because the other companies can check my identity, can be sure that I exist, and at the same time can prove that I exist and I live in the UK. So I don't know if you have any idea if there are any other governments which are, you know, implementing the same procedures.
I'm not aware of any privacy-friendly initiative of the UK government in that area. I don't know, Casper, do you know of any? There's usually a trapdoor, there's usually a twist. It appears that it's privacy-friendly, but when you dig into it, you discover there's a trapdoor. You discover there's all sorts of twists.
Good evening, I am Matteo, Professor Matteo from University of Naples, and I work for several projects for Italy government. We in Italy have deploying the a national card that identifies the citizen. And with this national card, the citizen has the possibility to access the all the government application and to contact the governance services. And I am working on Justice Ministry to introduce the electronic document in a legal way. And we are dividing the identity and the real information in an open fashion, in such a way that it's possible to verify both the attribute, the identity, and the attribute certificate of the citizen, that give them the possibility to access data and functions of the application. And this has a big impact on the legacy application because you must introduce open architecture standard in such a way that all the login information and all the authorization and other information are separated completely from the a traditional application and are managed by the EAM system that is a big filter and intelligent filter that give the people the opportunity to work with their data and their functions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're at five after four, so I was going to give a 10-minute summary of all the things that you just heard, but let me see if I can reduce it to a couple of sentences. I think we heard that authentication and ID management systems need to be understandable, flexible, and easy to use for them to be effective, that a universal ID system with a government or a private party holding all of the data is a bad idea. And then in order to move forward in this area, governments and industry need to work together collaboratively, because if either tries to do it on their own, there may be unintended consequences. So let me thank our panelists and Guy Sabin and the ICC and Marcelo for all of their help in sponsoring this and putting on the program today. And thank you all for coming.